A final talk for the morning is Michael Donnan, who won the Chadwick Prize last night, on moral particularism, which I should be fascinated in. I have a feeling it may touch on one or two of the other subjects we've already had, and I'll be very interested to see how they all tie together. I think this is the coping stone of the morning session, and I think we're going to run over 5 minutes, because we're 5 minutes late, but that's not too bad for the whole morning. Thank you, Eric. Michael.
Thank you. Is my voice loud enough for the whole... moral particularism. Well, this is a comparatively recent doctrine in the field of normative ethics. It's been a subject of vigorous debate only for about the last 3 decades. Accordingly, it may not be as familiar as the classical theories of ethics to you, so I see my task today is indicating just the main features of this idea. Now, to give you a flavour of moral particularism, I should like to start with a quotation from one of its pioneers, John McDowell. This is on your handout for ease of reference. Occasion by occasion, one knows what to do, if one does. Not by applying universal principles, but being a certain kind of person, one who sees situations in a certain distinctive way. Now, echoing this, the leading protagonist of moral particularism, that's Jonathan Dancy, recently wrote, "Particularists think that moral judgment can get along perfectly well without any appeal to principles. Indeed, that there is no essential link between being a full moral agent and having principles." Now, that's also in the handout. Now, all of this seems rather iconoclastic, given the revered status of the person of principle. So we need to look at the justification of this idea. It's easier to look at what particularism is reacting against, and that's the more traditional generalist moral theories. They're generalist because they are normally predicated on a general principle or a set of general principles. Now, as time is short, I'm only going to consider the application of moral theories to the deontic evaluation of actions. That's to say whether the action is morally right or wrong. Now, on the handout, again for ease of reference, I've given you the 3 main categories of deontic evaluation. I crit these from Mark Tibbins' book, which he wrote in 2002. So an action is obligatory if one ought morally to perform it. An action is forbidden if one ought morally not to perform it. An action is merely permissible if it is neither obligatory nor forbidden. Now, as a warning, if you read the literature, you'll find that the terminology does vary, but that's a reasonable classification. In fact, you can work with just 2 classifications. An action that's forbidden is wrong. An action that's obligatory or merely permissible can be regarded as right. Now, I take it that one purpose of a moral theory, insofar as it applies to the question of right action, is to ascertain the deontic status of actions, and typically it does this by proposing a moral principle or a set of principles that, as Simmons puts it, purports to set forth the conditions under which an action is right or wrong. Now, this is on the level of theory. However, we also expect to be able to apply the moral theory in practice. To do this, one identifies the features of the action under consideration, and you determine whether the conditions specified by the moral principle are fulfilled. I think it's important to note that the principle of action does its work by specifying non-moral features of actions. And it's in terms of these that the action is deemed to be right or wrong. So in many ways, the principle acts like a criterion against which you judge your action. Now, the generalist thesis is the relation between those moral properties, the non-moral properties, and the set of your moral properties is codifiable by a fixed set of principles or rules. Some people say that the moral supervenes on the non-moral, and the relation between these two levels is determined or codifiable by your principles. This is something which moral particularism denies. Now, on the handouts, I've given a couple of definitions which you'll find in Dance's recent work, Ethics Without Principles. Moral generalism, the very possibility of moral thought and judgment, depends on the provision of a suitable supply of moral principles. Against this, Dance opposes moral particularism. The very possibility of moral thought and judgment does not depend on the provision of a suitable supply of moral principles. No. How does this work in practice? Well, consider the following example. A husband tires of his wife and wishes to set up house with his foozy, who happens to have expensive tastes. The husband murders his wife in the hope of benefiting from the insurance. Now, let's suppose that a generalist espouses a very simple moral theory that comprises the principle that an action is wrong if it involves the killing of a person. So, for this generalist, the husband's action is wrong since it contains the non-moral feature that a person is killed. Now, look at the principle that the generalist has invoked. And here I'm following a paper by Simon Kirchin. This principle actually involves two claims. The first is that the fact that a person is killed is always wrong-making. The second claim is that the wrongness due to the killing of the person cannot be overridden by any other consideration. That's comprising that simple moral theory. So the generalist is here claiming to the picture that the morality of actions can be subsumed under a set of one or more principles that provide criteria for the judging of the rightness or wrongness of any action. Now, Dempsey calls this the subsumptive option, and he offers three reasons why this option should be rejected. Before we go to those objections, again, in the handout, we should find a definition of the subsumptive option. There is at least one universal moral principle, and moral agents may therefore proceed to make each moral decision by seeing what that principle tells them to do in each particular case. My definition comes from Roger Crisp, who in fact opposes particularism. It's not Dance's definition. So what does Dance object to this option? Well, the first idea is that this option can't make sense of the notion of moral conflict. It certainly can happen that one finds oneself in a morally significant situation in which the considerations for an action and the considerations against it seem fairly balanced. If you recall the example given by Sartre about the young Frenchman during World War II, who's the sole carer for his aged and frail mother, but he's agonizing over whether to leave her or to fight in the French resistance. Now, according to the subsumptive option, such moral conflict could not occur. And this is because once the appropriate principle has been selected, its application to the features of the action can only generate one answer. So that stands his first objection. The second one is somewhat related. It's hard to accommodate on this option a sense of regret. Now, suppose you are the local football team's only competent goalkeeper. You're on the way to catch the train to the venue to go to a very important promotion match. However, on the way to the station, you come across a lost child. By the time you phone the police and waited with the child until they arrive, you've missed the train. Owing to your absence, the team loses. Now, I assume that the moral principle to which you subscribe generated the result that your action in attending to the lost child was morally right. In which case, it's very difficult to see why you should feel regret at not performing a morally wrong action. It's almost certain that you will feel regret if you miss the train. Now, the third objection is perhaps a little slightly more technical. Dancy asks, how are we to know which principles are the right ones and which are mere pretenders? Dancy observes that one cannot hope to extract principles from our judgments about particular cases. The reason is that the judgment of the rightness or wrongness presupposes on the substantive option that a principle is already available. So there you're entering onto a regress, and as you know, philosophers dislike regresses. Well, and get this to work. This is a shame that he's not the only person who has stated the art of gravity. I think I'll introduce another thesis which is commonly linked with the substantive option, and that's to do with the individual effect of morally relevant properties themselves. Now, imagine you've got an old fashioned set of scales. One pan is the right-making pan. That is, of course, the wrong-making pan. You've got a fulcrum, and you've got a scale, that's morally balanced. That's wrong, and that's right. Now, your action, one reason is, if you take into consideration, is reason X for acting this way. That goes into the wrong-making pan. That one is one which makes the action right. Goes into that pan. Now, the idea is that reason X and a different action will still go into the same pan. Reason Y, a different action, will still go into the right-making pan. Now, this is called moral polarity or moral valency. You'll find both terms in the art and the literature. It should be on the handout, but isn't, so that's why I've written it up. The valency or polarity of a morally relevant feature is whether it's right-making or wrong-making, whether it counts for or against an action. Now, the generalist idea is that the polarity of a morally relevant feature is fixed. And that is called by Dancy the idea of atomism. And again, that's not my handout. A feature that is a reason in one case must remain a reason and retain the same polarity in any other. And I urge you not to push the scales metaphor too far, because you simply can't weigh reasons like you do rats and bacon. So let's just give an idea of the constant input that a reason has to your decision-making process. Now, in the literature there's a complication that Dancy doesn't talk about morally relevant features so much as reasons to act. I think the point is that these features provide reasons to act in a particular way, or in some cases not to act. So, what's the attack on atomism? Let's go back to the husband and wife example. Let's assume that the floozy is just a figment of the wife's imagination, and she attacks her husband with a carving knife, and with such ferocity he has no choice but to kill her in self-defense. So the husband's action, I think, could be described as at least morally permissible. So the particularist will now address the generalist and say, well, your simple moral principle is quite inadequate. So how can generalists reply? Well, one way of doing this is to say, well, I'll amend the principle so that an action is wrong if it involves the killing of a person in self-defense, in which case, principle is an action is wrong if it involves the killing of a person except in self-defense, in which case the action is right. Now, that's tantamount to having one principle with a proviso. And again, I think this just encounters the regret and the moral conflict objections. Now, the other thing that the generalist can do is to dispense with the claim that you can state in advance what sort of feature will override the others. Again, this is an idea of encouraging. But you can still hold on to the claim that the killing of a person is always wrong-making. What is being dropped here is the idea that its moral valency can't be overridden. So the idea is there may be a set of reasons variously for or against an action that can accept that which reason prevails depends on the nature of the individual case under consideration. Let's call these contributory reasons. Now, this option maintains the view that such reasons do not vary in terms of their valency, but they still must count in some way. So if lying counts against an action in one situation, it counts against an action in any other situation. It can be overridden. So, for example, if lying is wrong-making in court, especially if it results in a conviction of an innocent person, it's still wrong-making if you lie to the secret police, but you haven't seen the dissident they're seeking when all the time he's hiding in your loft. In the latter case, the feature of saving a life takes moral precedence and provides an overriding reason to mislead the secret police. So, what are the objections to this idea of moral atomism? Well, here we can point to various counterexamples. For instance, the breaking of promise is generally wrong-making, but not in the case of a promise made under duress or when one is being defrauded. In the latter cases, the moral import of the act of making a promise is simply annulled, i.e. it loses its normal moral potency. Indeed, breaking a promise to return the farmer's shotgun that you borrowed is actually right-making if the farmer has quit and is threatening to shoot strangers on sight when he gets his gun back. And I think that the idea that reasons have a constant moral valency does seem to lead to some odd results. Assume that the execution of a person on the sole ground that he's an aristocrat is wrong-making. Assume, too, that the generation of pleasure is right-making. Now, if an innocent French nobleman is guillotined in secret, and there are no other moral considerations, the action is wrong. However, if the execution is carried out in public, the manifest pleasure of the mob counts in favour of the action. But surely the pleasure generated doesn't lessen the wrongness of the action, it actually makes it worse. So here the moral valency has not just been annulled, it's been actually reversed. The second objection raised by Jansen to atomism is a challenge to generalists to produce a clear argument in support of the view that contributory reasons are invariant as regards their moral valency. Jansen suggests that no such argument has been put forward. And the epistemological variant is to ask how we can tell from cases that have been considered as a morally relevant feature in those cases will still function in the same way in the future. So in short, Dancy is opposing atomism of reasons with holism of reasons. And that's defined, a feature is a reason in one case, a reason in one case may be no reason at all, or an opposite reason in another. I've recorded that on the handout too. Now we've looked at holism and atomism at the level of reasons and what are the relevant features, and we've looked at principles. Now how do these tie up? Well, Crisp has offered two possible theses, which he refers to as strong particularism and weak particularism, respectively. Strong particularism: any feature that's a reason in one case must remain a reason and retain the same polarity in any other, so there can be no general or universal principle stating the reason giving status in any such feature. There's a detuned version of this, the weak particularism. A feature that is a reason in one case may be no reason at all, or an opposite reason, or always the same reason in another. If there turns out to be no feature that's always the same, then there will be no general or universal principle stating the reason-giving status of that feature. Now, of course, moral particularism is subject to a number of criticisms. However, as I say, in all the best textbooks, I leave those as an exercise to the audience.
Thank you very much, Michael.
We have 10 minutes for questions. Phil.
The rather central feature of Jansen's thought is this holism of reason. I wonder if you could expand on that a little more.
Yes, well, Fancy holds that reasons are affected by the context in which they occur, not just in the moral sphere, but in other spheres. His argument is that if holism is appropriate in these other spheres, why should moral reason be any different? To give an example, normally, this is Dancer's example, if you see a patch of red in front of you, this is normally a very good reason to take it that you're perceiving a red object. However, if you take a drug, it alters your system such that red always looks blue to you and blue always looks red, then the fact that you've got a red patch in front of you, or you seem to have a red patch in front of you, is actually not a reason to assume that you've got a red object there. It's a reason to assume you've got a blue object. Similarly, if there's a location, the fact that there's no one there might be a good reason for going. Alternatively, it could be a reason not to go. Sometimes job applicants' enthusiasm is a good reason to give them the job. Sometimes it's not. So these are the general non-moral considerations which Dancy then feels he can carry over into the moral sphere. If I can just expand on this, there is an objection raised by Chris amongst others, Robert Chris. He feels that Dancy is obscuring an important difference between sort of essential reasons and non-essential reasons. Example, if you're the location with no one there, if there's a reason for going to this place, it's because you're seeking solitude, perhaps you want to reflect on some philosophical problem. But if it's a party and no one's ever turned up, there's a reason for not going there. But in each case, the underlying reason is that you're seeking some form of pleasure. And that's the ultimate reason, the essential reason. And Tripp's idea is that Dancy's losing sight of fact you have reasons and underlying essential reasons.
Can I just very quick follow? It seems to me to follow from that account that what Dancy is up to is in a way almost dropping the notion of there being a special realm of moral discourse. I'm suggesting that, in fact, everything's continuous. It's just a question of reasons for action. In other words, if you examine the whole subject of the way in which we decide to act, morality is just a part of that. There ceases to be a special reason for moral reasons. There's just reasons.
I think, in one way, I would agree with you. I think the underlying way that reasons work seems to be, on Dancy's view, continuous over the whole area of discourse, moral or otherwise. But I think moral discourse is special because of the importance of its subject matter. Going to parties or not is one thing, but deciding on things like capital punishment, treatment of animals, the whole thing becomes extremely important. So I think the debate is sharpened because morality seems to be such an important part of our lives.
No.
Yes, I think following on from that, Kant had a universalizability would function as a distinguishing mark of moral judgments and requires that there be some we talked about it before, that some consistency in applying a judgment to anyone else in relatively similar circumstances. I'm not clear whether particularism is supposed to deny that. I don't think it need deny that on your definition, a suitable supply of moral principles, because if you can point to a relatively different, relevantly different feature of the other case, so to speak, and maintain some kind of consistency. This is your giving reasons and finding overriding reasons why it isn't the same. Then it seems to me you're all right under the universalizability test. And then the question is whether you go on indefinitely providing these broader reasons which imply some kind of principle which still can be overridden by further reasons, and whether that is fatal to it. I mean, whether you need to have finally this suitable supply of moral principles in some kind of tablets of stone sense, which I doubt, but it still seems to me you can reconcile the two in terms of being able to pursue the argument until you can't come to something which the other guy doesn't question. And that seems to me the essential feature, the essential difference between moral discussion and giving reason generally.
Yeah, well, the question is that once you and your interlocutor have come to some agreement, it's whether in fact you can then apply some kind of inductive reasoning to extract a principle that's going to be suitable in other cases.
But other things being equal.
Yes, that reduces principles to something like laws of nature, which have this ceteris paribus, all things being equal. And in moral discourse, the all things being equal loom extremely large. So that really reduces, I think, principles, lead to the level of guidelines. That's one point. I don't think anyone would quibble that in most cases doing harm to an innocent person is wrong. But some utilitarian pieces, for the greater good, that might be what you have to do. I think with the weak particularism, you're not actually excluding the possibility of some moral principles that are extremely robust. I think that's the point. But whether they in fact help you to, as it were, provide a map of the moral terrain, I don't know.
Peter, yes, can I just say, don't leave it until the end of an answer to indicate that you want, because I will get your name down. After Peter, I've got one on the list at the moment.
Just a question. In what way would you distinguish this, call it anti-principle principle, from virtue ethics, except in so far virtue ethics is slightly more practical.
Well, this is something which I think I've asked raised about virtue ethics. For me, the problem with virtue ethics is that it's essentially circular. You define a virtuous person, or you recognize a virtuous person by the fact they do acts which you characterize as virtuous. So how do you get your handle on the notion of virtue in the first place? So there's a fairly slight circle, I think, that the virtue ethicist has to get out of. I think there's one thing in common with virtue ethics, and I think that when you come to consider moral reasons, you have to apply a sense of judgment. I think Aristotle called it phronesis. You have to have a mature, aware judgment facility to decide how these various reasons balance, or perhaps not balance. I think this is something you acquire not through principles, but through experience. Gerald Dworkin made the point that when you're developing into an adult, no one takes you on their knee and says, look here, young man or young woman, Kant says this or Mill says that. You learn your moral sense by various things like parables, Aesop's fables, homely applications of the golden rule. You didn't like it when Johnny stole your toy, so don't steal Agatha's toy. And various sort of ways that you just absorb, hopefully, a decent moral sense. So I think that gives you a path to acquire, whereas I think if you say virtue ethics, it could lead to the circularity of it. Hard to see how you break into that.
Well, one, I would say that it's a formal social contract, but never mind, that's good, Kelly.
Final quick question.
If we take a suitably general view of utilitarianism, whereby rather than maximising happiness, we're maximising utility, so it could be much more sophisticated, and also we allow each of us to have our own utility functions, but we discuss with each other what they are, do you think it might be the case that moral particularism and some of the other theories are actually special cases of utilitarianism corresponding to a particular choice of our utility function?
This is sort of work in progress, but one thing that worries me about moral principles is this. It goes back, I think someone mentioned Moore and his open question argument. You might say that this particular action increases utility, but it's still an open question. Is that action good? Is it right? Is it wrong? And I think what happens with these principles, and I think this also applies to Kantianism, what you get is not this action is good, but this action is good by the light of this particular principle. And the danger here is, I think, it's been mentioned recently, that you can get to a kind of rule fetishism, that you follow the rule blindly, or you follow Kantian prescriptions blindly, thinking you're doing the right thing, but in fact you're not. But you're acting on a rule. So I think anyone who holds a theory based on a moral principle somehow still has the job of showing that what they're prescribing or what they're recommending is good, and you can do no other than fall back on your moral judgment to ascertain whether the action is good or wrong. And if you've got cases like moral conflict, it goes back to Gans's argument, how are they going to judge that, how are they going to accommodate the idea of moral conflict if you've got a principle that can only describe one particular answer in that situation.
Thank you, Michael. It's now lunchtime. Thank you very much. This afternoon we've got another innovation. As far as we have two debates, Tom will introduce that at 2:30 when that's due back. Meantime.